Welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And in this episode, I'm joined by Joe Giesing, who's one of our contributors. And Joe is also the former fan club editor for Nazareth, Samson and Cozy Powell. And Joe has also contributed to Record Collector magazine since 1991, where he's published over 250 interviews. Well, for Now Spinning magazine, he's been off to the Gloucestershire countryside to talk to one of the most recognised fantasy artists in the UK, and that artist is Rodney Matthews. Now, if you're a rock fan, and you're a fan of bands like Nazareth, Magnum, Praying Mantis or Eloy, there's a good chance you're familiar with Rodney's fantastic artwork. Well, Joe has been off to talk to Rodney about his latest projects, his history, his inspirations, and everything you can possibly think of that Rodney's been involved with. So I'm going to hand over to Joe now, and here is an interview with Rodney Matthews.
Barclay, go and lie down.
Hi, this is Joe with my good friend Rodney Matthews.
Hello, Joe.
How are you doing these days?
Still standing.
Yeah. So, current projects-wise, I understand you've been doing quite well with this Yendor.
Yes, it's been surprisingly good in terms of, it's a 17-minute short animated film. It's not 3D animation, it's sort of cut-out animation. And it follows along behind the Yendor book that we published ourselves here, Sarah and myself. It did really well on the animation film circuit, and got a lot of laurels and statuettes and stuff that we got from it. So I gathered that the film people like, the critics like it.
Yeah.
We haven't got a broadcast yet, but we are playing to get it on Amazon Prime. Yeah. Still waiting for an answer there. Not counting chickens before they hatch, but it's been exciting to work on, and we're very grateful that our Kickstarter campaign was successful. We got the money that we needed to finish it.
Yeah.
Because we put a lot of our own money in, and then we needed some to finish it. People did respond rather well, so thank you to them. And that's a dog growling. We're so sort of convinced that it will eventually go to broadcast that we're working on a second film, a second short. And I've done loads of backgrounds and critters and stuff that will feature in it. Possibly. The illustration-wise, half the work has been done for a second one.
Right.
So, yeah, we're very pleased with it.
Yeah. Your artwork famously spans a lot of books, LP covers and posters. The recent colouring in books you've got coming out, does that cover the broad spectrum?
Yeah. You mean the coffee table?
The colouring books you've got.
The colouring books, yeah. A fairly broad spectrum because in terms of, the rock stuff I've done, but it is done by a company called Rock and Roll Colouring, so it is to do with the music side of what I've done. So everything in there is from a record cover of one sort or another.
Yeah.
Some more rock than others, some more prog. A good broad spectrum. I'm quite pleased with the way that has been received.
Yeah. And I understand that there was a coffee table, you mentioned a coffee table book being planned, about 600 images.
Well, it could be more, but I think what Sarah said just now was that I've done around 600 colour images in my time, probably more than that now because that was some years ago I calculated that. The people doing it, it's a Centipede Press, they want this book to be to cover all of my coloured artwork.
Right.
Artworks right from the start, which should make this quite a large book.
Yeah.
You know, you get a free wheelbarrow with it, I think. But he's likely to take another year and a half to get that together before you right. see that published. But it's a good thing to hang around and wait for. I mean, if he were to decide he wanted all my pencil sketches, then, you know, he'd have to do about 3 volumes of the same type. Done quite a lot of gaming stuff that nobody's ever seen.
Yeah. You've had quite a long relationship with Magnum, and especially Tony Clarkin over the years.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you got into working with Magnum back in the 80s.
Well, it goes back to the time I used to read Melody Maker and Sounds and all those papers that were quite large, you know, they were almost like newspapers. And I remember in one such publication, there was this article, interview actually with Tony Clarkin.
Yeah.
I just liked the sound of, you know, his worldview and everything, the way he looked at his music and, you know, it's almost like poetry, some of the stuff he writes. And I thought, I think I could get on well with this bloke. And I contacted him through, I think, a record company. Was it? I wrote to the Melody Maker or Sounds or whatever one it was, and got hold of him that way. And he happened to be a Michael Moorcock fan, which you could tell from listening to some of the lyrics in that day.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd done quite a bit of stuff for Moorcock, and I got to talk and showed him some examples of what I'd done, and he then said, "Well, yes, we'd like to use you on our next album." And that was Chase the Dragon. And Chase the Dragon is the only record cover I've done for Magnum, which is entirely my own design.
Right.
Everything else has been well thought through and penciled out on the proverbial beer mat or whatever comes to hand by Tony Clarkin.
Yeah.
And he's got that way of saying basically what he's looking for in terms of the image. And then as the conversation goes on, he says, it's a bit like Columbo, you know, hangs around the door and goes back and says something else. He says, "Oh, and also I want this in it." And you think, all right, that's going to take another 5 hours. And, could I have such and such in it? And in the end, you're doing a really complicated piece of artwork.
Yeah.
With no expectation of actually making any profit from it. But, you know, we've had a great relationship over the years, and, you know, we got it worked out so that we benefit. They can do the T-shirts and stuff, and we do prints from their designs. It's been very, very sort of mutually beneficial.
Yeah. And what happens with the next album, The 11th Hour, which I understand you had problems getting paid.
That was the second one on Jet, if I remember. And The 11th Hour was, I remember Tony Clarkin saying that the title, The 11th Hour, and he's speaking tongue-in-cheek at this point, he said was really because Jet Records left everything to the last minute before they did anything. But I think if you can sort of remember the design, it was a slightly apocalyptic, and it was really saying, you know, that world affairs are coming to the point where, you know, we ought to consider we are in the last days of of humanity in terms of what we're doing to our planet and, you know, how we're behaving to each other as the nations of the world. But to the original comment, Jet Jet owed me money for that design. And of course, I had no leverage because there was no other plan to use Jet for another album after that. And I wrote to them quite a bit, and I got ignored, completely ignored. And I thought, well, I need to pay a visit to their office. So I happened to be in London at the offices of Big O, who published my posters and stuff at that time. And the proprietor, Peter Ledebor, is quite a big bloke, you know. He's quite... He does look like he could handle himself. In actual fact, he couldn't hit his way at a wet paper bag, but he looked the part, you know. And we went round together. And these were in the days when you could actually walk into somebody's office without being confronted or having to speak to a little thing on the door, you know, and give an account of yourself and stuff. Went up to the reception desk, and I said in quite a loud voice, so it's this sort of open plan sort of office there for a lot of people working in at desks. And I said, I've come to talk to someone about the money that Jet owes me for the Magnum job, the 11th hour job. And she said, well, I'm afraid there's no one here that could speak to you at the moment. They're all here, there and everywhere, you know. And I sort of made us to, you know, I was quite determined that I'd speak to somebody. And I sort of strode forth into this office with a determined look on my face with Peter behind me. And I heard somebody whispering, he's brought a heavy with him. And people were like excusing themselves and sort of leaving the room and stuff like that. And in the end, I you know, never seen such cowardice displayed in a record company office before, but I didn't get to speak to anybody who knew anything about it or was prepared to admit they did. And I had to leave. And then afterwards, you know, I heard all these tales about Don Arden, you know, being the hard man in the record business and very difficult to persuade to do things he didn't want to do. So somebody said to me, you should petition for their bankruptcy. And it was not really as expensive as I thought. So that is what I did. And I learned after that other people had been in the same problem with the company and had done the same thing. So with all this pressure around them, they had to pay me or pack up, you know, and pay the other people, presumably. So, you know, I was quite proud of myself that I managed to get money out of Jet Records, who were at that time were not known for distributing money easily.
And those two album covers were then used on in the background of On the Storyteller's Night.
Yes, they were. I just had my final dig, you know.
And that's one of your most iconic, isn't it?
As it turns out, it's been the one that people identify with most. I don't think it's entirely down to the image. I think that Clarkin's music on there, the lyrics in particular, are exceptional. I always think of him as a poet for our age, rock poet. I think the music is very good. It's one of those occasions when things seem to come together nicely. I didn't sort of... Clarkin said to me, well, we need an image of someone telling a story to some individuals. And that was about it. And I thought, well, at that time, I'm a big Arthur Rackham fan. And I thought at that time, I was doing quite a few pictures for goblins and little, you know, creatures and pictures and all the rest of it. And I thought, this is an opportunity for me to get that sort of image. And there's this pub in a place called Norton St. Philip that I had an occasional pint in. And it's very, very old. And I didn't go in there and sketch it. I didn't. It was just I remembered a few bits and pieces that started the ball rolling. You know, that atmosphere of a pub, very old-fashioned pub in medieval times, with these funny little blokes sitting around with their clay pipes, listening to this story by this cloaked individual. And it all gave a sort of a mysterious and slightly sort of, how shall I put it? The characters in it were being told something quite scary.
Yeah.
Hence the expressions on the bloke is spilling beer on himself because he's shocked. I also managed to get my dog in it. And
which you've tried to do quite a lot since, haven't you?
Yeah, it became a bit of a habit. Sharon and me still have a dog here at the moment. It's not appeared on a Magnum album, but who knows?
The
whole thing seemed to take on that that sort of slightly scary look. And in fact, I've often thought that it would be great to do, I haven't got the time, mind you, but it'd be great to do the same scene from the other end of the table that they're sitting around. And there you get to see the storyteller facing you.
Yeah.
And you get to see and they all have the same sort of surprised sort of attitude to the pose.
But the glow of the fire reflecting off their faces.
Pardon?
The glow of the fire reflecting off their faces.
Well, that's right, yeah. You could get some really nice effects. But what I then thought, it'd make a good animation, you know, like an NFT type animation.
Yeah.
Where you got a bit of movement, the smoke would be curling around the top of the seating there.
Yeah.
But for just a split second in the animation, the storyteller's face would change into a skull.
Yeah.
Just quickly like that, and then off again.
Yeah.
And that is the point at which they're all shocked.
Yeah.
Because the story is it would be quite frightening, but that particular event is that he sort of somehow or another momentarily changes into a skeletal character.
Yeah.
And that is a point at which they really freak out.
Yeah. So the new Magnum album, which doesn't feature your artwork, can we put to bed the rumour of what happened?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to say that, you know, I'm still on very good terms with Tony Clarkin. There's been no change there. What happens is he turned up at my studio with an idea, which is what he usually does, for an image for the cover. I can't remember what the cover was going to be called, but it was different from the one they actually ended up with. We sort of discussed using an image that he said to me, do you ever see the poster that advertised Clockwork Orange?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah. He said, it's a bloke and his hat was pulled down and he was looking out from under his brow like this, a slightly aggressive look. He said, I want someone with that sort of look to them in a suit holding out an apple in front of them.
Yeah.
Behind him is a rusty old time machine of some sort.
Yeah.
He had an idea where he could. I said, "Well, look. I don't easily sort of fall into the category of a figure artist. I'm not a very good figure artist, despite the fact that I did figure work at art college. Basically, I don't like drawing people, not normal people. They got to be strange in some sort of way. But this bloke had a suit on and that. So I said, just so that there's a bit of clarity here, could you get me some reference to, you know, the sort of thing you're looking for.
Yeah.
And then I'll do the rest. And so he went away intending to do that. And it was some, I don't know, weeks later, and still waiting. And I didn't care too much because I was had a lot of work on the Endo project at the time.
Yeah.
Then eventually he rings me with what's the sort of voice he had? It was an apologetic sort of voice. And he said, "Look, I don't want you to be offended here, but, you know, we've decided to go for a different approach on the next album."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, that's perfectly okay. No problem. No offence taken. That would be great." And I said, "As a matter of fact, you know, I've got loads of work on, and even though I would have no problem doing your album, it sort of takes a bit of pressure off me if you don't want to, if you want to go with somebody else for this one." And it was very, you know, we were both very easygoing about the thing, and there was no no shouting or objections or anything. That was it. And so he then went and he got this you know, someone to do a completely different sort of thing for the album cover. Great. That was more or less the end of the story, but for the fact that somehow or another the whole thing got distorted.
Yeah.
And to the point where it was sort of suggested that I had said, "I can't do your album cover, I'm too busy."
Yeah.
And that was not what was said. That was not the case. And where it all came from, I don't know, but that was what was circulated. And I was a bit upset about it, really. But as far as, you know, Tony and the band are concerned, I'm busy doing other stuff. But, you know, the relationship I have with Magnum is still intact.
Yeah. Cool. You mentioned NFTs. Are you working on with more of those?
Yeah, I did some a while back with a company which will remain nameless because Sarah and me worked on this and we paid an animator for it, but they just didn't seem to have the right mechanism in place to market my sort of stuff, which is, you know, fantasy art. They were fantasy, what I suppose would be termed as classics that I'd done, were featured in this series of NFTs. It was still available, but it just didn't work out.
Okay.
The whole thing didn't work out.
An NFT being non-fungible token.
Yeah, that's the word.
What is an NFT to a layman?
I don't know. I'm a layman when it comes to that. I just provide the image and give instructions to an animator as what I want doing.
Right.
Sarah works with me and she does a lot of the... It's very much the same as the Yendor animation. We work together, Sarah and myself, and she does everything to do with a computer.
Yeah.
And... you know, like sort of phasing from black and white pencil sketch into colour on some of them. And
yeah,
she worked out all that. You know, we then pass it over to our tame animator, who's a very nice, talented bloke, to work on. And it's really a sort of direction we've taken, not necessarily to NFTs, but to have my work animated at long last. I've touched on animation before, but at the moment I'm determined that I'm going to do stuff that I've been waiting most of my career to do. Because what has been happening over 50 years or so, I've been helping other people to sell their vision, either on book covers or record covers or things like that. Now, I've decided, or we've decided, we want to do our own stuff. And animation is something that's long been neglected. Although I've done computer game designs and things like that, it's just we just want to do it where we're in control.
And, yeah.
And it seems to work better because, you know, we've had great receptions from our stuff that we've done. NFTs don't understand the whole thing. there's a lot I don't understand about what happens to my work once I've done it. But I suppose, you know, I don't want to be a jack of all trades. I do the artwork. I then pass it over to somebody who does understand what an NFT is. And hopefully the next time round, somebody who knows how to market the NFT properly.
Yeah.
But we've done the Princess Margaret NFT.
Oh, well, we did, yeah. We did another NFT for someone who did... he's actually a friend of mine, Ken Griffiths. And he was a photographer of some note. Quite a famous photographer, actually. He passed away some sort of years ago. But nice bloke, good sense of humour. Shared some glasses of red wine with him and listened to his tall stories. He took some pictures of Princess Margaret.
Right.
Back in the, you know, before she passed away. One was quite famous. It was used in the press, you know, the sort of daily paper. I can't remember which one, might have been more than one. It was actually a well-known image. And his daughter recently decided that she would honour her father with an exhibition centred on this particular piece, on this particular photograph of Princess Margaret, and invite about, 20 artists or so to interpret that photograph in their own style.
Yeah.
To do something that had the essence of this photograph in it. So I did it was actually a pencil drawing, but we got it animated and she put on an exhibition in Soho. At the end of it, I still don't know what an NFT is, but, you know, several of the artists in it had NFTs made of their work. So yeah. it was interesting to see the extent of the animation that people put into it, because NFTs for me in the first place is something with very, very subtle animation. You almost missed it if you blinked an eye.
Yeah.
Now it seems like anything goes, you know, there's full blown animation with soundtracks and, you know.
Head north towards Muddy Path.
So that's my phone. I turned it off, actually.
Still trying to direct you here.
It is. So I understand that you're not doing so much new work for album covers, but still giving a lot of second rights.
Yeah, we've still got loads and loads of stuff lying about that can be used on album covers. It's just matching the music with the image. Recently, I don't know how many per year, but there are quite a lot of people who are happy to use an existing image for a reduced fee.
Yeah.
In the instance where their music fits the image. So when people get in touch, we say, well, we've got this and this. Does that tickle your fancy? Well, you know,
yeah.
And in some cases, we're doing quite a lot of that.
Yeah. An early one that I remember was Eloy's Metromania.
Right, yeah. That was a picture I'd done as a poster. It was actually something that I did it around the time when I was really impressed by the film Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And all the you know, the buildings, all the retrofitted buildings and sort of neon city lights and stuff everywhere. It was always raining in the film, so it was a pretty sort of dark-looking thing. Whilst it bears no immediate obvious resemblance to Blade Runner, it was Blade Runner that got me thinking about a city of the last days, so to speak. It's got a Bible theme in it, not not sort of obviously so, but the original had the face of Christ in the sky.
Yeah.
And which I had put in, this was before everyone had computers and when it was very easy to Photoshop something. This was long before that. So I painted the scene and then I got some people I know to fit the image into the sky before it was printed, so to speak, not a digital thing at all. It was done with smoke and mirrors and stuff, you know. It was a photographic sort of thing. And the image itself was what I'd taken from the Shroud of Turin.
Yeah.
The face of Christ that had a couple of coins on the eyes, and I just painted the eyes in.
Yeah.
So it was this figure in the sky. And the theme is one of, the sort of, I can't remember the Bible verse is based on. It's one from Matthew. It's about complacency. And there's this bloke playing a guitar, completely oblivious of what's going on around him. And this is, it's like saying, be watchful for, you know, not when I return, which is like the thing about the return of Christ to the earth at a time of great trouble. And Eloy approached me and said, can we use this image, but we don't want the face in it? And normally I would have said, well, you know, should I do something different then? But I'd done a couple of covers for them before, and I thought, well, you know, I can live with that. I'll let it be used without that face, because it was done as a poster. And so they used it without the face, obviously. Yeah. But I know that people who bought the poster and stuck it up on their walls, they say that, you know, people used to come and visit them and get really freaked out by it.
How much has your beliefs influenced your work?
Well, since 1980, it's always been there. And there have been various times that I've allowed myself to be over-influenced. You know, in terms of allegorical stuff in everything. But I put it into two categories. There's one where my Christian faith is can hardly be seen in it, but at the same time, the attitude with which I paint the stuff comes with not just me and my physical being, but in what I believe and what is in my soul, so to speak, and spirit, so to speak. And then there's the other side of it where I've been asked to do direct Bible images from descriptions from the Revelation and books like that.
Yeah.
You know, like fire and brimstone sort of stuff.
Would that include the Predator in Disguise album?
Sort of. Yeah, that was a bit of an in-betweener. There is no description of anything quite like that.
Yeah.
The feel of it, the essence of it, the meaning behind it is, it's a biblical thing. In other words, be warned, you know, we're getting to the end, so to speak. I suppose I've gone through that time, not so much now, probably, but where I might have been likened to the person who wanders down the high street with a sort of sandwich board on saying, repent for the hour is nigh, you know. Yeah. That sort of imagery. But the Revelation is about that sort of stuff. And most of it is like symbolic of future events, with the exception of one or two, which are past events. Some of them are quite well up my street, because you've got quite interesting imagery with dragony looking things and critters of one sort and another. Yeah. I think, you know, the Christian Christian heavy metal bands that I know have plundered my Revelation output for their covers for some time now, to the point where there's very little left.
That scene really took off in the early 90s, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Bands like Seventh Angel.
Seventh Angel, Detritus, Stairway, et cetera. I'm just trying to... What was the original question there, Joe? You can't remember either.
No, about your Christian beliefs and influencing your work.
How does it... Yeah. Well, I think I've gone past a stage where I try to stuff things down people's throats or... try to preach to people. Don't think that's the way I want to do things. But I find that people do get in touch with me and say sometimes your artwork has changed my life in some sort of way, hopefully or quite often for the better.
Yeah.
And I've often been puzzled as to why that is, because sometimes it's got no overtly Christian hidden between the eyes.
Yeah.
Image at all. I think it's just the attitude that I do stuff with. I try to make people aware of the of the conflict between good and evil, I suppose. And
well, I think the Planets and Time to Turn both do that, don't they?
That's right. It's a pretty good example. I'm also a creationist, being a Christian. After at one time being an evolutionist, fiercely so, and it just seems to me that things have become. It's not that I've joined some organisation that have a particular mission statement or belief worldview.
Yeah.
It's just that myself, I've always been interested in our natural world, and as a kid, spent all my time in the woods and fields, studying critters and plants and flowers and all the rest of it. That's a long story there.
Well, so much of your work is based on, you've got insects blown up to man's size.
Yeah,
and a lot of the curves and spires of cities could be the points of leaves.
Hmm. Yeah, I've always been fascinated by this possibility of either human beings being shrunk down to insect sizes or them being blown up. It's the fodder of quite a lot of fantasy films, huge insects and things like that. And all my life I've been fascinated by the stuff and the way the intricacy with which insects in particular work, but everything seems to be of some sort of intelligent design. And so whilst I'm not setting myself up as an authority on the differences between creationism and evolutionism, if those are the right terms, for me, it's been something like a sort of transformation. I came to the point where I could no longer sort of imagine that everything had come about by a load of chance happenings over millions of years.
Right.
It all seemed to have an intelligent design, a purpose. I know it's all gone rather wrong, so we do have this conflict, the Earth, but I mean, if you look in the Bible, you'll find that quite easily explained what happened, why we do have that.
Yeah. Over the years, what albums of or album or artwork has been most memorable for you?
Album artwork. Well, I think one of my favourites is Tiger Moth. So I did for an old friend, Ian Anderson, not Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull fame.
Oh, the Ian A. Anderson.
Ian A. Folk singer. I guess I knew him back in the 70s in Bristol, and I did quite a few album covers for him. And that's how I started off doing folk records and stuff in a studio in Bristol, Plastic Dog. The one I like that and Sextet, which was actually named Howling Moth. I think it's probably because he's a howling wolf band. I just got a real opportunity to do my insect thing there with both those albums. And I tried to get a bit of humour into it as well. You know, the two insects dancing with love in their eyes on the top of a piece of fungus with this huge tiger moth and a squeeze box. That is one of my favourite ones which I've done, which most people ignore roundly. I think the other one that was purpose designed is probably Storyteller's Night.
Yeah.
That keeps, that is a real evergreen, and people talk about that more than anything else.
Yeah.
So, what else is there?
The Hawkwind one, also a Moorcock book, is it The Concert at the End of Time?
Elric at the End of Time.
Yeah, isn't someone making a double neck guitar in that kind of style?
There's a bloke, a four-armed sort of semi-insectoid guitarist featured there. In fact, it's a bit of a take. When Michael Moorcock and myself, when we decided to do this collaboration, this book, he allowed me to come up with ideas to go into the text. So I'd say, how about an inverted landscape? And he'd say, okay, I'll write that in. And how about this and that and the other? He also knew my art and decided that here and there he put something in that he knew that I would like to illustrate.
Yeah.
And this scene was one of those. I obviously knew of his work with Hawkwind. That he occasionally clambered up on stage and played stuff and, uttered poetry and stuff. So that is really like a take on Hawkwind, that image. It's just, if you haven't got the image in front of us now, it was like a stage in a spacey environment. And there were, four musicians? We find there's a drummer, keyboard player playing something that looks a bit like a church organ. Saxophonist, bass guitarist and lead guitarist. It was like, it's been used on a Hawkwind album in the meantime. Yeah. I think it's Out of the Shadows, which is quite satisfying, really. There's something else I want to say about that. It's surprising. I still got the artwork.
Yeah.
And you've got some limited edition prints of it and stuff like that. But the artwork is here by a strange chance, because at the time I did it, I lived in North Somerset. But the people who were going to publish the book, Elric at the End of Time, Big O, they had offices in London and in Gloucester.
What?
Gloucester in the West Country. What I meant to Stroud Road, if that means anything to anyone. And I was sort of experiencing a lot of distractions at home. And the boss of Big O said to me, well, look, I've got an empty room here in the office. Just come up here and work.
Yeah.
At least until you finish the Elric book. So that is what I did. But what that necessitated is I used to go back to Somerset at weekends, and I had to take a huge piece of artwork with me.
Yeah.
You know, the actual image was 50 by 100. 75 by 100 centimetres plus the white edge of the board. So it was a full-size piece of art board, but nevertheless quite flimsy. And The only transport I had at my disposal at the time, you know, another car, but that was being used by my wife, was my Caterham 7, which is like a tiny little sports car
right.
with a tyre stuck on the back. And what I did every weekend is I lashed the artwork onto the back of the car behind the spare tyre. And I had to sort of go up the M5 for, I don't know, 30 miles or so with this piece of artwork flapping about behind. And I could see it in the wing mirrors, you know. And in those days, I tended to drive like a lunatic, so it flapped quite a lot. And it's surprising it's still here. It's a credit to the manufacturer to the art board. It's still stayed in one piece.
So what next?
Well, as far as the future of Rodney Matthews Studios is concerned, we're very we've got our heads firmly into the animation mode.
Yeah.
I'm working on a second Yandor short film. I've done about half the illustrations, at least. Loads of the backgrounds and the various critters. Don't want to say too much about it. There are a lot of critters in this one. And it's a little bit faster than the other one. Yandor does have a little flyer, a little flying machine in this one. So it's getting a little bit faster as we go. Quite exciting stuff. We may have a certain celebrity put some voiceover in it, but I'm not going to say any more than that because one does look stupid if it doesn't happen. As I said before, we're quite excited that the first Yandor animation is likely to appear on Amazon Prime, so people can get to watch it in its entirety. This is still an NFT project on the table. A lot of people don't like NFTs, I know that. I think they're eating up the world's resources, but some companies do actually use polygons. That much I do know about it, which is a lot more civilized.
While we're here, I'd just like to note...
Sorry, I was going to say...
Go on.
We did an album a little while back, and Sarah and me published it ourselves. I've been sort of accumulating ideas through the COVID-19 sort of period for some more music. I'm not saying there's going to be another full-blown double album, but there are loads of different ideas I've got for, lesser things with different people that I've been wanting to get out of my system for years.
Because you did release an album a couple of years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, Trinity.
Yeah. And you also, in a very fairly recently, issued, tracks for Christmas, such as I Saw Three Ships.
Yeah, that was using the same individuals as appeared on Trinity.
Yeah.
And I did another Christmas one with Oliver Waitman. That was, what was that called? In the bleak midwinter, actually.
Yeah.
Because Oliver lives quite near us, and it's quite easy to sort of get him involved in stuff.
Yeah.
He did the Yandor soundtrack.
Yeah, he's got to do the second Yandor. He's agreed to do the second soundtrack because he did the first one. So all these things are coming to. Are being firmed up a bit. The music side of my life and the art side of my life have never been more integrated as they are now.
So do you still play the drums?
I do have a drum room stuffed with various percussive items. I haven't done so much lately because, you know, I've been busy on other stuff. And quite frankly, apart from being good for your exercise, if I'm not actually practicing up for any musical event, there's not a huge amount of sense in, you know, burning up a lot of energy, which I, you know, I do need for other reasons. But I do, yeah, I'm still much very much into the drumming.
Your roots, there were jazz and progressive rock?
Yeah, they are really. Going back to the day when my dad was in a dance band and my sister played the piano, and there's always a lot of jazz records hanging around the house. My heroes of the day were people like Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, and you know, a bit later the modern jazz, you know, MJQ, Dave Brubeck. I recently saw, not recently, a couple of years ago now, a tour in the UK. It was Dave Brubeck's kids, and they were calling themselves Brubeck Plays Brubeck, and they were brilliant, particularly Dan Brubeck, the drummer.
Right.
You know, soloing in 5/4, I've never seen anything like it. I almost came home and burnt my drums.
Right. I also just want to add that while we've been sitting here talking, I'm looking at an original print from, or original bit of artwork from Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. Yeah, that is Painting the Roses. It's one that, because I sold these things at Chris Beatles Gallery in the past, and John Cleese was the one who bought, he bought a couple of pieces from the Alice series. That was one there he wanted to get his hands on at one point, but it's one that I gave to my wife, Sarah. So he's had to stand down.
Right.
It's a bit sort of nerve-wracking telling Basil Fawlty that you can't have something, but you know, every now and again, you have to get the priority right.
You do. And your website, what can people get through your website? Are they able to purchase art prints? Records?
They can get hold of prints of various types. You know, there's some limited edition lithos, there's the Gicle limited editions and open edition prints. What else can they get? Over to Sarah for that.
We've got a lot of original pencil drawings on there.
Yeah, we're selling quite a lot.
Yeah, and we're just going to wait to start putting up some colour pieces for the first time.
Right.
So, haven't actually done that on the website before, but, yeah, so it's time to maybe relinquish some originals so that we can get on with animation projects.
And maybe a discography up there of all Rodney's work, album covers.
Excellent.
With other ones.
We need to update all the information, and the plan is to have all of Rodney's images on there so that it's the go-to place for Rodney Matthews' images.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should point out at this stage of the proceedings that Sarah, my good lady wife, runs the business and does everything. So we're currently trying to find a way of grafting a couple of extra arms on her, because she has to do practically everything, knows my work better than me. She's from being, you know, sort of meeting me in the first place, she's learnt skills, things like Photoshop and animation and all sorts of things, which absolutely baffle me. Between us, we get everything done. But, I mean, I've really come around to being a person that wanders into the studio and picks up a paintbrush or a pencil now and again and fiddles about. But everything else is done by Sarah. So this is why I'm asking her what is on the website, because she puts up all the stuff for sale, deals with the customers when they buy something. There's quite a lot of interest in pencil sketches. Some of them based on album cover art, music generally. There's stuff, Alice in Wonderland and, you know, the children's books sort of type of stuff. We found that there are collectors at the moment wanting to get their hands on some of the colour pieces.
Yeah.
So we're sticking them on there and letting them squabble over them.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I wish you luck, sir.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in. That was absolutely fantastic and fascinating to find out what Rodney Matthews is working on now and a little bit of background, the kind of work he's been involved with and the rock bands he's worked with as well. So huge thanks to Joe for bringing that interview to us, and special thanks to Rodney Matthews for letting us broadcast it. And if you want to know more about Rodney Matthews' artwork, please go to rodneymatthewsstudios.com. That's rodneymatthewsstudios.com, where you can buy prints and artwork, and all the latest news can be found there. So please subscribe to Now Spinning Magazine, subscribe to the podcast, the YouTube channel, visit the website, and I shall look forward to seeing you on our next episode. Bye for now.